Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Cork Today replay on C103.
As we welcome you along to the programme, you can always email when we're, even when we're not on air. Our emails are always available to you, corktoday@c103.ie. And actually, Elizabeth from Bandon is already onto the programme this morning, wondering, picking up on a news story that I heard Barry covering there at 10, wondering what will it take to stop the teacher, Enoch Burke, turning up at what is now his former school in County Westmeath. Elizabeth feels particularly sorry for the pupils. She says it must be distressing for them, especially with all of this publicity surrounding this particular story. And actually, I was following a thread on Twitter yesterday when he had turned up at the school again yesterday. Now, bearing in mind, Friday of last week, it's a week ago, wasn't it, that he was handed his letter to say he's been dismissed from the school. So he is now up to that. He'd been suspended from his teaching post on full pay, but he was formally dismissed last Friday and he's turned up every day this week. And then people wondered, would he turn up again today? Because, of course, it was announced yesterday by the judge that if he turns up as and from today, if he stays there after 2 o'clock, then it is going to cost, he will be fined €700 a day for every day that he turns up at Wilson's Hospital School in Multifarnham in County Westmeath. And as I say, I saw a thread on Twitter yesterday with people saying if the press stopped turning up outside the door, because I'm looking at a picture that was taken this morning and there's camera crews and there's got to be 6, 7, maybe 8 journalists, they're all trying to get a statement from him. Of course, as always, even though he did speak yesterday, he doesn't take any questions from the press, but he did speak yesterday, particularly when he'd heard that the judge was imposing this fine of €700 per day. And, you know, the press were trying to ask him yesterday, you know, will he turn up? And he didn't answer that. But then he went on to explain why he was doing what he was doing. But people are saying if the press didn't turn up, maybe then he would stop turning up. But I don't know if he particularly is doing it to court publicity. I mean, if nothing else, regardless of how you feel about this story, this certainly seems to be a man who has a courage of his convictions. But it's going to be an expensive conviction because the High Court are saying €700 per day if he doesn't agree to obey. Because remember, it's a court order as well telling him he's not to be anywhere near the school. And of course, now that he's a former teacher of the school, because that's how he got arrested on Monday, because he's trespassing. I mean, if you're anywhere, if any adult is anywhere on a school premises that they haven't been invited onto, they can be arrested for trespass. So he was trespassing on the school and he was asked to leave and he didn't. Now, in fairness to the school, they haven't seemed to have got the Gardaí involved since. Every other day this week, he's been driven to school by his father, as his father always does and seemingly always did. He turns up at exactly the same time, 8:45, even though this morning they were a minute early, they were at 8:44, and he's just literally been standing outside. He's not allowed into the school, so he's been standing outside a door of the school. At one stage during the week, they managed to get him outside the gates. They closed the gates, but then the gates opened when a school bus was going in and he followed the bus in. And then again, standing outside the school, the principal has come out and told him to leave. He won't, and he stays there until literally close of business. He stays there for the duration of what would have been when he was teaching. His father then comes back and collects him at whatever time school closes on that particular day. But he, even with the threat now of fines of €700 a day, judging by today, it is still not going to deter him, even though how they are, he doesn't own property. He still lives at home with his parents. Now, he has said that he's been saving for a deposit for a house, so he does have savings. But I mean, how they're going to, will he pay the fine, will be the next one. So it's one of those stories that certainly isn't going away. And to answer Elizabeth's question, what will stop Enoch Burke from turning up at the school? I really don't know at this stage. I mean, I really don't know. He spent over 100 days in jail before Christmas. And I know it's one of the reasons that certainly the powers that be don't want to put him back in jail, because they felt that when he was in jail, it was only giving him the opportunity to promote his religious, his very extreme religious beliefs. And they felt that that was the wrong thing to do as well. So I don't know if jailing him is the answer either. Your thoughts welcomed, 0818 103 103. And now, we did speak yesterday about trains and about the fact that we don't have catering service back on trains. They went during the COVID pandemic, and that was understandable. There was very few people even using trains, and they didn't want people, you know, they didn't want trolleys going up and down the trains when everyone was trying to social distance and all of that. But there's no reason now why it can't be COVID rules as to why we don't have catering services. Irish Rail are saying that they can't get anyone to take up the contract to do it. And I this came into us via Twitter from Sinead, and I think this is a jolly good suggestion. She said, listening to you about the trains on your programme, how about offering new and small businesses, maybe start-up businesses, how about offering them a trial period to provide the service? It will then provide a service to the people on the train and will also provide an opportunity for a business, yeah, maybe a start-up business that's trying to sort of dip their toe in the water to see, I have a business idea, I think this can work, you know, maybe somebody making muffins and, you know, etc. The only thing, if it's a startup business and it's involving food, isn't there very strict criteria involved with that? But I think anything that will work to get food and provisions back onto the trains, I think certainly has to be looked at. I know Thomas Gould yesterday was saying that if Irish Rail, if they can't get a contractor to come on and do it, then Irish Rail should start, you know, rather than privatising that part of the service out, go back to, which I'm assuming, which they did at one stage, where they employ their own employees and run their own catering company on the actual train. 0818 103 103. John Paul taking your calls on Ukrainian refugees. And by the way, that meeting is going on this morning. This is to do with the modular, the proposal for modular houses to be erected at a site in Carrickeel in Mallow. We know that that meeting is happening this morning at 11 o'clock. And Councillor Tony O'Shea, who spoke to us yesterday on the programme, says that if he gets out before 1 o'clock, he'll join us on the programme just to find out what happened at that meeting that is taking place this morning. It is the local public representatives, and obviously the OPW are going to be there as well, and everybody sort of waiting to see what has happened. The contractor has gone in to take a look at the site and to see if the site is suitable for modular homes, so no doubt we'll have the results of what the company had to say as well. And if we get anything, as I say, before the close of the programme, we certainly will bring it to you. But a listener says, Patricia, in order for Ireland to continue to accommodate the huge number of Ukrainian refugees that are in this country and the possibility that they could come in the coming weeks and months, and to do it without prejudice, maybe the government should adopt a kind of a fair deal proposal. For every house built for a refugee, should another one be built for one of our own homeless? But bearing in mind, they're not building houses for refugees. These modular homes are very different to the physical building of houses. But maybe, yeah, I know the point you're making. If they're going to put in, say, 50 houses, we don't know how many houses will actually go into that site. I heard 34, but I heard somebody else say 50. So if you were, say, if it was 50, rounded off at 50, 25 would be used to house Ukrainian families, and then 25 would be used to take people off the council housing list in the area. Is that something that could be considered? Some of your thoughts and comments coming in on Enoch Burke, and what is it going to take to stop Enoch Burke turning up at his now former school, Wilson's Hospital School, because the threat of being fined €700 a day doesn't seem to be working, because he turned up again. again this morning. Jim says, Patricia, I think Eunuch Burke must be now identifying as a dog because he's like a dog following his master and he simply can't get him to go home, says Jim with a smiley emoji following his comment. Somebody else says, this is JC in Crosshaven, says, imagine, Patricia, this all started because a girl changed her name and he refused to call her by it. That is what this is all about. A Fomoy listener says, Patricia, the guy, this teacher, I must be going deaf because I didn't hear what he has done. Why is he not let into the school? It's a story that has been rumbling on now since, goodness me, I mean, he did 109 days in jail in the run-up to Christmas, which was certainly September, October of last year was when it started. But the reason now has got really nothing to do with what happened in the school, which was a pupil was deciding to transition from a boy to a girl, and it was to do with pronouns and what pronouns she wanted to be addressed as. That's what it started out as. But now, of course, the reason that he's before the courts is for contempt of court, because he had been suspended from school. He was told not to go anywhere near the school. He did. He ended up having to go to jail for that, and then they released him, and then he's since been dismissed from the school, and he's now turning up at school. So he's now there's trespass going on now, but it's to do with the court order more than anything else is the reason he's been fined. It's got nothing to do with his religious beliefs, even though Eunuch Burke will tell everyone it is to do with his religious beliefs. Somebody says, Patricia, honestly, I feel for that poor teacher. Didn't he have a right to his views? Are we living in a strict regime like Russia and Korea? It is disgraceful. We all have to be so careful now in what we say. Yeah, absolutely. He has a right to his beliefs, but doesn't that young student also have a right to his or her beliefs? And it turns out that the student in question, it was a general email that went around to everybody in the school to explain what was going on in this young student's life. As far as I know, Eunuch Burke wasn't even teaching that particular pupil, so wasn't even going to be coming in contact with the pupil. So I think, you know, when he decided to bring in his religious beliefs into it, and he has a right to his own religious beliefs and his own views, but so does the student and so does the school to back the pupil. Isn't that what schools are meant to do? And Rachel in Cork City says, hi Patricia, I totally agree with the listener expressing concern for the students in Wilson's Hospital School in County Westmeath. Any student who makes that really, really brave decision to come out at school deserves support and kindness. Well done to the school for standing up for that student and all members of the LGBT community. And that's from Rachel in Cork City. And hi Patricia, on the Eunuch Burke case, as I see it, the school are taking sides. If a teacher was asked to teach Irish and he or she says they wouldn't or couldn't, would they be fired? Well, that's something very different. You're asking somebody to teach a subject that they're not able to teach. That's completely different to what's going on here. He's been dismissed because he breached the rules of the school, and he now is continuing to breach the High Court action. So that's very different to somebody saying, I'm refusing to teach a particular subject.
This is Cork Today on C103.
Email Patricia now with your story or comment. CorkToday@c103.ie.
Now, hundreds of people gathered outside Leinster House yesterday to protest at the multi-million euro deal between Caolte and the British private investor fund Gresham House. Earlier this month, as we know, it was revealed the semi-state body made a 200 million euro deal with the UK Asset Management Fund. The Save Our Forest demonstration yesterday included more than 20 organisations, including the Rural Ireland organisation. And joining me from that group is Gerry Loftus. Good morning to Gerry.
Morning, Patricia. Good morning to your listeners.
You're very welcome to the programme. Now, the Agriculture Minister has pointed out that this deal with Gresham House is only 3.5% of Caolte's total ambition between now and 2050. Is it still wrong in your eyes?
That's totally incorrect. And this is a continuation, just briefly, so that people mightn't understand the forestry sector in Ireland. This is just a continuation of what we have there already. And what we have there already for years upon years upon years is taxpayers' money being blatantly abused by putting in place forest schemes so that the rich, to buy the land, they get a fence for free, tax-free, they get a fence for free, and then they plant it, which is all that stuff is done and granted it, and then they draw premiums for 20 years or whatever the time, usually 20, and that's all tax-free. So At the moment, we have about 800,000 hectares of fixed growth plantations in Ireland. About 50% of them are owned by Caoilte. And the 50% that's not owned by Caoilte are owned by rich people, investors, drawn down these lands. Some of them never stood near the land they own. It is corrupt as it possibly can be. It is put there to benefit the rich. It's all taxpayers' money. And one year, the year 2011, when Ireland was on its knees and when child benefit and pensions and every other social welfare benefit was cut, we still allocated something like 17 million euros to forestry that year. So this is a continuation of what's done here behind the backs of the people. Many high-profile politicians knew about this. We now know that two senior ex-Fine Gael ministers, Michael Darcy and Pat Cox, are employees or directors of Discretion House.
Now, are you sure of that? Are you?
Oh, that's been clarified.
Yeah,
Patricia,
yeah,
been clarified,
okay, yeah. All right.
And so this deal has been going on since 2020.
And what we're hearing from the minister and indeed from other government ministers is that it's a done deal. Contracts have been signed and that there's no way of unravelling this. Do you think there is a way of unravelling this particular deal?
Look, the Minister for Agriculture and the Minister for Public Expenditure are the two shareholders in Caoilte. This can be unravelled if there's a political will to do that. Simple as that. And I could, as we called for yesterday at the protest, if Deputy McConaughey Og and Deputy Hesketh cannot unravel this, well, didn't they need to resign? This has been totally done underhanded, totally been negotiated in secret the past 3 years, made known to the public a few days before Christmas when they thought to slip it under the carpet. And the people that does this behind the back of it, this is undemocratic, their own fit for public office, and the need to resign, as simple as that. And while they talk about 1% was the figure for us, now it's 3.5%, you mentioned it there.
They're saying 3.5%.
What the people of rural Ireland need to realise that this is only the tip of the iceberg if this gets away. Because the targets for planting are in or around 500,000 hectares between now and 2050. That's 1.5 million acres, Patricia. So you look at that. In that scale, what will happen? And what will happen is it will be a cleansing of the small farmers of rural Ireland because they've done this deliberately to small farmers to make them unviable to prepare for this. So you'll wipe out parishes, you'll wipe out villages, you'll wipe out townland, you'll remove people. When you remove people out of that part, you remove people out of small villages, out of small towns, you will close doctor surgeries, jobs, pubs, schools, GA clubs, and so on. Because when you have massive hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of secret fruit plantations in a county anywhere, and this is where we're going.
Yeah, it doesn't benefit.
There, like.
Yeah, I mean, large forests don't, they do nothing for an economy of a local community.
Correct and right. And like the big problem that is, well, it's unbelievable that we've agreed, party and government, we've agreed Minister for Junior Minister for Agriculture, Minister for Forestry. We know that nothing lives in a secret fruit plantation. We know it's fertilised from the air in straight into water. We know it's sprayed chemical from the air to prevent disease straight into water. We know nothing lives, not even an insect lives in it. We know it's highly polluted. The thickest blue plantation, the pine needles are highly acidic into water, killed fish, etc., etc. And we have 800,000 hectares of that planted already. And we want to go plant more of it.
I was reading that the current forest cover in Ireland remains at less than 12%. And seemingly that's way below the European average. And forests are recognised as being central to our future green economy and a means of increasing carbon capture and of renewable energy sources. Are you saying that we don't need any more afforestation?
I'm not. I'm saying whatever forestation. First of all, secret fruit plantations need to be banned. Secondly, we have planted the wrong tree in the wrong place for all these years. We have planted secret fruit on bog or peat soil, if you want to call it, now scientifically proven to be the most valuable soil in the world to sequester carbon. 3% of the soil in the world is peat soil. That 3% absorbs and stores more carbon than twice the amount of trees in the world. That's how valuable bog soil is now. And here we have a situation in Ireland where we have 800 all these trees planted on this bog. It's drying out the bog, whereas the bog should be absorbing and storing carbon. Instead of that, because of it being dried out by the trees, it's emitting carbon. it's letting carbon up into the atmosphere. It's a disastrous failure on the behalf of Creelshire and on behalf of the government.
And there is a lot of political opposition, Gerry, to this plan. And obviously from your the protest that happened yesterday, I mean, I'm assuming you're seeing that same level of protest on the ground all over the country.
Oh my God, of course we are. We have getting telephone. We're getting calls from England and America, never mind from you, Patricia. That's a fact. People are so concerned about this because as the information gets out, like, and as we explain the reality of it, as I talked about the 1.5 million acres between now and 2050, you see, people know what's going to be. They understand it now. And what should be happening here, you know, we're talking about an 18% cover. But every country is different. The geography of every country is different. And that percentage, for a start, number one, should be looked at. Because we have so many small farms. We have so much water. We have so much streams. We have so much lakes. We're different to places like Germany, where you might get 5,000 acres on a farm and have a lake or a river in it. So there's a lot of things to be looked at.
You can't compare like with like.
Yeah. And how it needs to be done here is that whatever trees we're going to plant, our farmers are going to plant, and farmers were willing to do their part here, they were, for climate change and do a bit. But we are advising them to do nothing now. And they're agreeing. Well, this is sorted, nothing. But it should be led from communities, by farmers, broadleaf trees, which would be a benefit to the economy, walks, etc., whatever. And this should be, of course, from the government, because the farmer gives up, say, 5 acres of his land to plant broadleaf trees. That is an indefinite service. It's for the rest of his life, and it's for his children or whoever comes after him. So he should be paid for that 5 acres while them trees are in the ground, a public good to this state in absorbing and storing carbon. That is where we should be going. And instead of planting Sika spruce, we need to develop the hemp industry. The hemp industry has thousands of different uses. It's been developed in many, many countries right all over the world. Why are we not doing this here?
Okay. All right. So there's a lot more to go on this. I'm assuming that the group that has now been set up, Save Our Forest, Save Our Land, will be hearing and seeing a lot more from that group, Gerry.
You will. The Rural Ireland organisation is only about 2 years old. We're known now countrywide at the minute. We're just building our website at the minute, Patricia.
Okay.
But anyone that wants, or anyone wants to talk to me, you're feel free to give them my number.
Okay, we will indeed.
We will be holding meetings here, there, and everywhere.
And I have a feeling we'll be speaking again, Gerry. In the meantime, thank you for that, and thanks for joining us on the programme.
Thank you very much.
Good morning to you. Bye bye. That is Gerry Loftus of the Rural Ireland organisation. He is based in County Mayo. According to data collected by CompleteCar.ie, there is a rural urban divide when it comes to passing your driving test, with the pass rate at some test centres in Cork nearly twice as high as the pass rates in Dublin. To discuss the data, I'm joined by Shane O'Donoghue, who is editor of CompleteCar.ie. Good morning to you, Shane.
Good morning, Patricia.
You are very welcome to the programme. By the way, we've always known in Cork that we're better drivers than people in Dublin. Just to put that out there at the start. Can you start by sharing some of the figures, like the highest pass rate versus the lowest pass rate?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'd like to say that we didn't compile it ourselves.
Okay.
The RSA has put this data out, so it's very much from an official authority. But regardless, the highest pass rate is actually very local. It's Ballincollig in Cork. It's 75.3% pass rate, which is actually very, very good, especially when the average for the whole country is around 53%. Now, that contrasts then with, as you said, parts of Dublin. There's Mulhuddard in Dublin. There's a couple of centres up there, and they have 43%. Actually, the lowest is 38%, 38.2%.
Wow. That's a huge,
which is a massive difference.
Huge, huge difference. I mean, is it that people who, particularly like Ballincollig, and there was other parts of Cork did well as well. Now, Skibbereen had a pass rate of only 43.3%. But is it that people are better prepared when they go for their test?
I think it's very hard. We can only put forth theories really and discuss it. But looking at the data, it's very limited. But it's very difficult to say, because what's to say that Ballincollig people are so much better prepared than people in Mulhuddard and Dublin? I mean, my theory is a bit different, and it is only a theory, isn't that some areas it's easier to pass it in. You know, the road layout, the junctions, and also perhaps the familiarity of those roads with the, for the people that are going for their tests there. So in Ballincollig, perhaps, I mean, to be fair, the Ballincollig roads, while it is very busy, the roads are quite sensibly laid out. The junctions and roundabouts, it's not a difficult place to get around as a driver, as a new driver specifically. Whereas, and you would expect a lot of people going for their tests there probably know the area. And, you know, if they've had lessons, the instructor has probably been able to tell them where the tests would be done or roughly. So that helps a lot. Whereas in bigger areas, perhaps like parts of Dublin there, you probably have people coming from further away in the city and wouldn't be familiar with the area. It's busier again than Ballincollig. There's a lot more traffic. And the junctions are perhaps slightly trickier, I would say. I know that area. But that is just a theory, really. We don't have anything more than that.
Yeah, because when I was thinking about somebody, you know, trying to do a test in Dublin, I mean, a learner driver taking a test, say, during rush hour, you can't pick the time that you're going to do your test. That must be a nightmare.
Yeah, I suspect people try and stay away from doing that. I mean, the problem, of course, depending on where you are, is you just be stop-start, and that's of no use to anybody. So yeah, there's just generally more traffic in built up areas, but Ballincollig is busy too.
That's a good point. Yeah.
But this isn't the first year we've had these results from the RSA. They are similar to the year before. So it's not like they're an anomaly in any way. There's definitely something going on there. I'd really like to see the demographics, of the people that are passing and failing, et cetera. I think that might paint a better picture.
Is it also down to the testers, or do the testers move around from centre to centre?
I'm not aware that they move around centre to centre. And if they do, I presume it's only within a certain geographical region. I think that's definitely something that needs to be considered. We wouldn't want to criticise testers and suggest that some are easier than others and some are harder than others. But there is a human factor there. You know, they have certain things they're supposed to be looking out for. They have a checklist effectively, and, you know, you get marks if you do certain things wrong. But, you know, there's some human interpretation of that. So that's certainly a possible factor.
Yeah. But even looking at the fact that the average pass rate across all the centres last year was 53%. So that means just over one in two people who sat the test passed, which means, you know, nearly half of everyone who took a test last year failed and has to go back and do it again. I mean, I don't know. We haven't covered it now in quite some time. I don't know what the wait list is like for a driving test, but it's one of those ones that comes up every now and again. Somebody trying to get a driving test and they can't get one, you know, in a short time period. Do we need to look at the whole system? I mean, why is nearly half everybody failing their tests?
I agree with you. I do think we need to look at the whole system. I don't think we need to make it easier, I should point out. Definitely not. We need our drivers to be safe, but people need to be better prepared before they're going for that test. One other little detail, and I wonder, is it captured in that figure, is that if you have a provisional license, you can hold it for 2 years and you have to go for a test. However, all you have to have done is applied for a test, got a date. You don't have to turn up and then you can go and get another provisional again. So I wonder, are the figures showing that there's a bit of that going on, that people are only applying for a test because they have to, and then they're just actually not bothering turning up and they're just continuing with the provisional license. That might explain some of the poor data there.
That's a really good point. And of course, when we get the figures from the RSA, they don't do a breakdown. They don't say of the failure rate, how many were, well, they weren't technically a failure. The person just didn't show up.
Yes, but and again, I think I'd love to see the detailed data there, but I'm assuming that if you don't turn up, it's counted as a fail. I might
yeah.
be wrong on that.
Yeah, I would as well. Yeah, at. Yeah. But yeah, but there, that's the kind of information we need from the RSA. And then what about nerves? I mean, like Marion has said, would Shane have any advice for somebody who has failed their test? Wait for this now, Shane. 9 times. Nerves gets the better of her every time and she ends up making silly mistakes. She said, I really am a good, safe driver. Never been in an accident. I just can't pass the bloody test.
It's so hard on people like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, all tests are nerve-wracking and this perhaps more than any. And I don't know, the only advice is just to get as much practice as you can. You know, it is just a test to get over. And I would suggest that you, like you alluded to, we could do a major overhaul anyway while we're testing and preparing people for using the roads rather than passing a test. But I think people who are trying to pass the test, they need to practice. There's no substitute for it. And also try and practice in the region of the test centre. You'll be familiar with the roads around there. You know, you're likely to come across the junctions, etc., that the testers go through. And then practice the manoeuvres, all the parking, all that. It's just practice. It's the only way to do it.
Yeah, and I would also suggest, because obviously if Marion has done it 9 times, I would take lessons. Even though she's obviously driving many, many years, but get lessons in advance of the test, because, you know, some of the driving testers are the instructors, they'll be able to see what the tester is looking for.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, regardless of how many times you've gone for a test or how long you have been driving, I would suggest that you definitely need a few refresher lessons just before the test. Those instructors will pick up on any little things that you might not have realized you're doing that the testers won't like. And they might give you pointers as well. And it'll also put your mind at ease. It'll help with the nerves.
Yeah. And I know something we discovered a number of years ago from somebody who'd failed numerous times, when I think it was on their 5th time failing. And when they said it to the tester, that's my 5th time failing, the tester said, I wish you'd told me that at the beginning. So I think make the tester aware that you have failed a number of times and that you are nervous. You know, they're aware of that.
I think that's a very good idea, actually. That's a really good point. And your listener would do well to listen to that point.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to fool the tester into, you know, thinking that you're this experienced, brilliant driver. They're humans as well. I mean, they don't have anything against you. They want to make sure you're a safe driver. But, you know, they're not there to scare you. It's not like that.
OK. All right. Listen, Shane, thank you for that. And thanks for joining us on the programme.
Thanks, Patricia.
Good morning to you. That is Shane O'Donoghue, and Shane is editor of CompleteCar.ie. And I was on the website yesterday. It is exactly what it says on the tin. It's everything to do with cars and driving. It's a fascinating website, CompleteCar.ie. 0818 103 103. Now, this made me laugh when I mentioned earlier that I was going to be talking about driving tests. Anne says, listening to you there, Patricia, talking to Ken about passing the driving test, I was awfully nervous when I was doing mine, and I ended up having to do it 3 times before I finally passed. Now, the first time I failed, I was asked to do a 3-point turn and I did it all wrong, so I knew immediately that I had failed. But listen to this. Anne said, the second time I did it, I got into the wrong car, and it was actually a car that was owned by a member of An Garda Síochána. But my keys opened the door of this other car. It was only when I sat in, I noticed the colour of the seats were red and the colour of my seats were black. So that had to be explained to the tester, I'm in the wrong car. So after that, I was just so nervous, I really couldn't drive properly. Guess what? I failed the second time. Third time round, though, I was lucky. I did pass. When I came home to my mom, she had been praying to St. Jude for hopeless cases. So the prayers paid off, and you're good driving, and you didn't let the nerves get the better of you. Thank you for that, Anne. And Gerard on Twitter at C103 Cork says, passing a test is a brain train exercise. Driving skill is a totally different matter, as can be witnessed by poor driving standards on so many of our roads every day. Willie by text, and this is to do with people passing their driving test. Willie says, I'm originally from Tipperary, living in Cork now for the past 19 years, and I have never ever seen driving as bad as present. People driving, not using their indicators, people constantly on their phones, texting and talking. How some of these people ever passed their driving test day one, beggars belief. They haven't a clue, if you ask me, says Willie. And how many people will say you'll never drive again the way you drove for your driving test? You're extremely careful. But then I think probably the longer we're driving, some people, not everyone, some people get really, really complacent about it. And of course, a lot of people would have passed driving tests way before mobile phones ever came out. And I have to agree with you, Willie, I am noticing more and more people, particularly when you're parked at traffic lights, the amount of people that are on their phones, either have their phone up to their ears or you can see them looking at their phone. And as for texting while driving, I mean, it's just completely nonsensical. It It really is. Thank you for your WhatsApp to 086 2103 103. We're going to take a break. We have news at 11 on the way.
Cork Today on C103
with Corrigan Insurance's Macroom, now part of McCarthy Insurance Group. Want great advice? You know who to talk to. CMIG.ie.
You're listening to Cork Today on replay. Phone and text lines are currently closed.
Kathleen has been on, and this is to do with prescription drugs. When she got a prescription from her GP, she went along into the chemist, and the chemist were giving her a generic version of the drug that she had been prescribed by her doctor. She wasn't happy with that. She wanted the branded one. She had to get on to the GP, and the GP has sorted it out and has now written on her prescription that her drugs are not to be substituted. So she wanted to make other people aware of this. Now, that's been going on, I think, for nearly 10 years. I remember when that there was a new law actually came in where the government was allowing pharmacists to substitute different versions of the same prescribed medicines. If a branded name medicine, for example, was prescribed by your doctor, the pharmacist then could dispense a generic brand. And remember, a generic brand does the very same thing. It's a substitute. It's a cheaper substitute than the named brand. And you'll only be offered a generic drug if it does the exact same job as the one that is on your prescription. But if you don't, for some reason, some people don't like to use the generic brand, which, as I say, is always cheaper because it's come off license. That's the reason that they're able to offer a generic version of it. You can at your doctor's, and they'll write on it no substitute. And I remember at one stage Marsha was on, can't even remember what the tablet was for, but she ended up getting a generic one, and the generic tablet was bigger than the brand one that she had been prescribed, and I just couldn't. She was quite young at the time. I just couldn't. She was having a problem swallowing the larger tablet. So what happened then was the doctor just used to write, every time she got a prescription, would write on it, do not substitute. So that's something that you can do. You can do with your own doctor. But pharmacists, yes, will offer you the generic one because the generic one is cheaper, and obviously they're trying to save you money as well when you're paying for your prescriptions. That's, as I say, that has been going on for quite some time. 0818 103 103. We discussed Caolte in the last hour, and that protest that was held yesterday, and objections. Well, I think in the main, the objections are to what Caolte has done with this deal, this contract that they've signed with Gresham House, and a lot of people are not happy with that. But then when we were talking with Jerry Loftus, he's worried about afforestation. He's worried about where all these trees are going to be planted. But we know that planting trees is good, and forests are recognised as being central to our future green economy because it's a means of increasing carbon capture, and obviously it's a renewable energy source as well. So a listener says, on Caolte and tree planting, I used to live in Perth in Australia, and the local government used to do a volunteer tree planting every weekend during winter. And winter, of course, is similar to winter in Australia, is springtime over here. It was lovely to bring the children and get involved. It was run by the City of Stirling in Perth, and they provided the baby trees, etc. You were just asked to bring along your gloves and a sun hat. You could go online and see which area and which streets were being done, and then just simply tag along. Very community and environmentally conscious, and very forward thinking, particularly encouraging children to get involved. No reason why Caolte couldn't do something similar here in this country. Think outside the box a little bit. That sounds like a wonderful way to get people to plant trees. Thank you for that. Now, we are trying to get onto the NDLS for Kieran, and I'll give this out to see if others are having problems, and especially as we've been talking about the driving test and driving licences today. Kieran says, I've been trying to renew my wife's driving licence on the NDLS website. I've been trying to do it over the last few days, and still today the website is saying license renewal application section is offline for scheduled maintenance. Any possibility you can find out what the situation might be? So we're going to get on to the NDLS just to see, because that does happen, and I accept that websites have to come offline for scheduled maintenance, but it seems to, according to Kieran, it seems to be off for a few days, and normally they'll do a lot of that scheduled maintenance kind of at night, and the, you know, won't be off, and 24 hours usually is the most it's off. But if it's been off for a few days, it does seem to be something's going on there. So we're going to get on to the NDLS and just see, has anybody else been having the same problem? This is for people trying to renew their license online. Some of your thoughts coming into us on Enoch Burke, the teacher who has once again turned back up at the school that he's now been dismissed from, and he's it's going to be costly for him to turn up to school now, €700 a day fine. Eddie in Bandon said that teacher had a contract with the school. His contract with the school was to teach. If he has his own religious beliefs, that's absolutely fine, but he must remember he is contracted by the school to teach, nothing else. And if he can't adhere to that contract, then he's broken it, and hence the reason that he has been dismissed. He needs to remember, as everybody, when you go to work, you sign a contract, and that's the contract you sign day one. His was to teach and nothing else. I take it Eddie not having sympathy for him. Morning, Patricia. I stand with Enoch. He's entitled to his views, and I feel he is being discriminated against as well. People died for their religious beliefs in times gone by. I say fair play to Enoch for sticking with his beliefs. Well, he certainly does seem to have the courage of his convictions, because I really thought that when the judge came out yesterday and said if he turns up at the school anytime after 2 o'clock today, it's going to be €700 per day. Now, let's wait and see. Does he leave before 2 o'clock today? But, you know, I listened to a piece. I saw a piece of him talking yesterday outside of the school when he heard about the judge's decision, and he seemed quite adamant that it wasn't going to deter him in any way. So let's just wait and see. On modular homes, Martin says, these modular homes that has been discussed this morning, that meeting, by the way, underway now, and John Paul was just talking to me during the news, it's unlikely that the meeting is going to be over before the close of business at 1 o'clock today. So we're going to keep a slot free on Monday morning, and we'll certainly get back to see what comes out of the meeting today. But anyway, Martin says, just around the general discussion of modular houses for Ukrainian refugees, and we're told by the OPW they've ordered 700 of them, and 700 are going to go into various sites around the country. And the long term plan is then that when the war ends, and please God that war ends sooner rather than later, that the majority of Ukrainian refugees will go back. I mean, that's traditionally what has happened in previous wartime situations, that they'll go back home, and obviously these modular homes then will become available for social housing. That's the long term plan with them. Anyway, Martin says, on the modular homes, why can we not have these modular homes in every town and every village in Ireland? My daughter and her 2-year-old daughter are trying desperately to get a council house, and I'm sure they'd love to live in one of these modular homes. Why are the government housing the Ukrainians first and not the Irish? It is a big, big disgrace, Patricia. It's not right. It's inhumane. The government should be looking very closely at their actions. It's all wrong. Look after your own first. That's what my late mother used to always say. And I did ask Tony O'Shea that yesterday. Has the council ever looked at modular homes? There has been talk about them in the past. I mean, before the war in Ukraine started. And then there was a renewed emphasis when the government realised that they were going to have to find accommodation for the Ukrainian refugees that were fleeing here. But I don't know. Now, we'll try and check. I don't know if any council, local authority, has built modular homes to house people on their own housing lists. But certainly, Tony O'Shea says here in Cork County Council, we don't seem to have built any modular homes. Don't know about the city. We'll see if we can find out if any modular homes been built across Cork City and County. And I'm talking about building them for social housing, for people to take people off the council housing list. Morning, Patricia. First of all, before anyone presumes I'm racist, can I just get it out there and say I'm not racist, but I tell you what I am. Says this listener listening to us in Killarney, I'm actually terrified of some of the people that are coming into this country. They're coming in without any vetting. The people that arrive, I feel, should be placed in some kind of a holding area in Dublin Airport. And then when they come in, do full vetting and process them there so that we know exactly who's coming into this country. And then, and only then, can they be placed into communities and live next to other Irish people. To tell you the truth, I actually now don't feel safe in my own country anymore. If I was younger, I'd be gone from this country. Australia is where I would go. If you look at Australia, they always seem to put their citizens' safety seems to be paramount. I'm actually a terrified Irish citizen living in Killarney. God, that's a desperately sad, isn't it? Desperately sad text. And I know Killarney has taken a huge, I don't know what the actual numbers are now, but they've taken a huge proportion of not just Ukrainian refugees, but also international people looking for international protection, people coming from all host of different countries. And it's 25% of the beds in Killarney are now gone to, are now being used to house refugees, not just Ukrainian refugees, but also people seeking international protection. So obviously it's making this listener feel a little bit unsafe, which is unfair if it's her own hometown. Morning, Patricia. You were talking about trains. Whatever happened to Network Catering? They used to provide the full catering service. That was when CIE ran the trains. I think they operated out of Houston Station. Does anybody remember them? Network Catering. Might be worth finding out what happened to them. I know people who worked for them over the years, says John. And was Network Catering then, was it fully owned by CIE? I mean, that was the point that Thomas Gould made yesterday, that if Irish Rail can't get a private company to come in and operate the contract for it, then should they start employing their own people and set up their own business instead? Hi, Patricia. This is on the driving test. Pat reckons with so many people passing and failing their driving test, could it just be a money racket to get more money out of people? Because, of course, you have to pay every time you sit your driving test. Hi, Patricia. When I passed my driving test in Mallow a number of years ago, I reversed up onto a footpath and I asked, can I do that part again? And the driver said, why? Anyway, Patricia, I passed the test. Maybe he didn't realise you'd driven up onto the footpath. It was a guy from the RSA who was the tester. He never even looked at the mark sheet. All he said was, drive on. I did drink a whole bottle of the Back Rescue Remedy before the test. That's a North Cork listener. I took that. No, I didn't drink a bottle of it. I took that. I find that Rescue Remedy great, but you don't drink a bottle of it. You put a few drops on your tongue. It's meant to calm you down. And listen, I don't know if it's a placebo effect or not, but I've certainly used it before. And I know I did. I exactly did that. I think it was 10 drops you had to put on your tongue. And that's what I did before my driving test as well. Did it work or not? I don't know. But yes, I did pass first time round. And Martin in Fermoy says, there are drivers in Fermoy, men and women, who should never be behind the wheel of a car. They just don't know how to drive. They haven't a clue what to do, particularly when the lights turn green. Also, some driving at night without their proper lights on. How these people ever passed their driving test, says Martin, is beyond me. And another one, all the people on their phones while driving. It's a common thing here in Fermoy to do this. I've had some very close near misses and all I could do is laugh. Oh, sorry, that isn't Martin. That's a local Fermoy resident. Well, I don't know if I had a close shave, would I actually be laughing? I had a close shave actually the other day. I was coming out of a junction and the lights were green. I turned green, but somebody coming the other way, and I could see the whites of her eye. It was an elderly lady. She obviously decided, I'll make it across the junction. It was down at the bridge in Mallow, which is a very busy junction. She decided she would make it across before the lights for me coming over the bridge was going to go green. Oh my God, talk about slapping on the brakes. And it was a near, that was a near miss. I certainly wasn't laughing. I could feel my heart pounding. And I looked at the poor woman as if to say, it's okay, it's okay. Because I'm sure she got an awful fright as well. 0818 103 103. John Paul, taking your calls.
C103 Jobs.
Community employment positions are available in Ballincollig. It's for drivers, maintenance and general operatives. You email Marguerite at westgatefoundation.ie. Pat Enright, Glass and Glazing in Mallow. They are looking for window fitters and general labourers. Call 022 504 50. An early years educator with QQI level 5, that's required for Bantyre Community Childcare. CVs please to Mary at bantyrechildcare.ie. And ward personnel are recruiting construction labourers, ground workers, machine drivers and all types of carpenters. You can call them at 021 233 9120. You'll find all the details and more job opportunities by going online now. Just go to c103.ie/jobs for more. This is C103.
Cork Today on C103.
With Corrigan Insurance's Macroom, now part of McCarthy Insurance Group, for motor, home, business, farm, life and health insurance. CMIG.ie.
Now, recently an Australian podcast went up online. It's under the series Stuff the British Stole. And one of the stories outlined how a chalice with North Cork origins ended up in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, where it still is to this day. Cork North West Dáil Deputy Michael Moynihan is now calling on the government to begin discussions with the UK to kindly return the Mount Keith chalice to its rightful home. And Deputy Michael Moynihan joins me. Good morning to you, Michael.
Good morning, Patricia.
And now, I listened with great interest to this podcast. Have you listened? Have you listened to the podcast?
Yes.
Well worth the listen. I suppose for people who know nothing about the Mount Keith chalice, just give us a bit of a history lesson, firstly, about the early days and what's known about the early days. It dates back to the 16th century.
Well, absolutely. It is understood that it was made in 1590 by a Charles O'Keefe. That's the inscription on it, C. O'Keefe. It's understood that it's Charles O'Keefe that got it made. And this chalice was used during penal times when masses were not allowed to be said and that there were vigorous pursuit of anyone that was saying masses. And then, you know, the various mass rocks all over the countryside, not alone just the Duhalla region, but the countryside. But then there were two priests that were murdered in Newmarket. And this chalice was buried prior to they being captured. And there is a gap, I suppose, in where the chalice was for almost 200 years. And then the chalice shows up again, or is reputed to be documented from the 1860s onwards. And then it was auctioned in 1915. There's a dispute about how it came into certain ownership in the late 1800s. But I suppose the facts we have is that it was auctioned in 1915, and then it went from there and has ended up in the Victorian and Albert Museum in London. It's a hugely, I suppose, decorative piece of work. It's a chalice, I suppose. It has huge historical connotations. It has huge historical significance around that time. But I suppose in a lot of the history that is unearthed over recent years, you know, a lot of rural communities have a whole lot of important historical incidents that have taken place. And I feel that a lot of that has been lost, and that, you know, some people have a hugely important...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Modern traditions, and there are one or two people in each community, and the people of Newmarket and the entire Duhalla region, you know, have a huge debt of gratitude to Raymond O'Sullivan for the information he has, and there are many more historians around the place that have correlated information, and I have great sense of regret when I see some of it lost.
Yeah, absolutely. And is it more of historical importance than financial worth?
Well, I think, you know, it's in a museum in London. It was clearly a product of Ireland. It was made in commissioned, as I understand it, by Charles O'Keefe, who was residing in the market in the greater Duhalla region. And I think that, you know, our history, why should our history be on display in a museum in London? Why isn't it back in Cork? Why isn't it back in our own community? Because we have huge historical significance. You know, even, you know, some of the local songs, and you know, they go back to that time and they go back to incidents that took place and the huge challenges that were there for the during that period of penal law, where people were trying to profess a religious their religion, their Catholic religion, and they were being pursued, all of that, a lot of that history, you know, is, you know, in one or two chapters, which is, it's vast, it's very there's a huge amount of it that's being lost. And I think that this chalice, when I heard about this chalice, and I said, look, that is something that is very important. It is a significant, I suppose, to that period, to the penal laws. It's also significant to what happened locally. And why shouldn't it be returned? And I think that we should be looking for these pieces of our history to be returned so that the people of the area can... you know, that they can understand where they come from and they can understand the historical significance of it.
Okay, now the London, that museum, Victoria and Albert Museum, will say, look, we went to auction in 1929. We bought it fairly and squarely. I think they bought it for £400 at the time, which I'm told is about €25,000 in today's money. If they were to give it back, do we have to financially compensate them?
Well, I suppose therein lies a very significant debate, right? You know, how did it end up in the Victoria and Albert Museum? Like, was it originally stolen from Ireland? It was taken from us. I don't think that when it was taken at the very, very start that anybody was paid for it. I think it was stolen and then it disappeared. And then it was, you know, at various stages over 400 years, who was the ownership of it. But the legitimate ownership of it, we could contend is the Irish people and the people of Duhalla. And I think that, you know, they could... I think to bring a holistic approach to history and to have an understanding of it, they have to say, yes, it was belonging to the people of the Duhalla region of Mount Keith or Newmarket, and that it should be returned there, so that the people of that area, like if you were, how many people will walk through the Victoria and Albert Museum on a even in the course of the year that would have heard of Mount Keith or Newmarket or County Cork?
No one. Only people from the area. And is it true that the two priests that were murdered in around 1680, there's actually a stone marking the spot where they died? Is there?
Well, that's what I'm led to believe. Exactly where they were murdered, there's a stone still there. And you know, a lot of that oral history of something significant happening and that there was a stone market, in my experience over the years, an awful lot of that turns out to be actually accurate and truth. And like sometimes there is cynics and they dismiss it, but a lot of the information on different, but I think that it is marking it in the spot where they were murdered. And I suppose that and the chalice and, you know, the whole historical significance of it, I think it is important that is recognised and that is important that is documented and that is within our own community as well, within the Newmarket and the Duhalla region, so that, you know, there's an awful lot of people that would be looking for that kind of information for the Duhalla region, any of the Facebooks that they have people coming from Australia and America and all over trying to trace their families back. But they'd also like to see what was the historical significance of our part of the world, which there is a lot of.
Yeah. And is it up to our National Museum to contact the Victoria and Albert Museum and get into some kind of negotiations? I don't know how this works.
Well, that's the protocol in it, right? We could go over and we could knock on the door and say, you know, give us back our chalice. It belongs to the people of Duhalla. But if we have to go through the proper channel, I suppose the reality is that the museum, the Irish government should make the initial and, you know, go through the proper channels to ensure that we can get it back. But I think, you know, it would be museum to museum or department of heritage to department of heritage.
Yeah, I'm sure I read somewhere that when, you know, it's been drawn to the attention of the Victoria and Albert Museum that we want our chalice back. I'm sure I read somewhere that they've offered, they would get into negotiations to loan the chalice to us. Not good enough for you?
Well, I suppose, you know, the question there is, are they loaning something to us that is already ours? And like there is a question on that. But like, you know, there's a fundamental question on that. Like, this was an Irish chalice and it ended up in the Victoria Museum in London. You know, how it got there is a matter of dispute that I would contend. But at the end of the day, I do think that if negotiations were proper, that we should get it back and have it within our own community, within our own country. It is, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, it is a fine piece of work that was done in the 1500s. It is a beautiful, and has survived 400 years, is a beautiful piece of history.
And very much part of our history. Very much part. And I can see a lot of people are saying well done for raising this issue, including Jim, to say hi, Patricia. It's all the more galling for this chalice to be in England when it was made as a result of what the English did to the Irish people, stopping them saying mass and practicing their own religion. And to think that two priests were murdered as a result, so it should rightfully be returned to Newmarket. And that's my final question to you. If we did get it back, where would you like to see it put on display, Michael?
I would certainly love to see it in Cultura in Newmarket. Yeah. I think it would be. I think, you know, in Newmarket, and there's a huge amount of history within the Newmarket region going back over the centuries, and a lot of it, individuals have it. Raymond has a huge amount of it, which we are eternally grateful for him to share it. But there's a huge amount of it that is lost as well and should be brought into fore, because people love that information and document it. But that's what I would love if it were possible. But certainly I would be talking to see what can do. But if it was to be returned to Ireland, obviously it's a very valuable chalice and, you know, security and everything else. But I would love to see it in Newmarket.
Okay. All right. Listen, Michael, we'll leave it there. Thank you for that. And thanks for joining us. That is Deputy Michael Moynihan. And it is deemed one of Ireland's oldest religious artefacts. Actually, the notes, I was looking, trying to get some information on it yesterday. The notes that go with the chalice, if you go into the V&A Museum in London, says this chalice is grand in proportion for a large congregation and is engraved with the crucifix and the instruments of the Passion, objects associated with Christ's suffering and crucifixion. And then it's inscribed in Latin, C-O-K, had me made in the year of the Lord, 1590. That's how we know how old the chalice is. And the C-O-K, of course, refers to Charles O'Keefe. Earlier this week, we were congratulating Toher National School in Dunmanway because we discovered they had won first prize for design in a nationwide 3D printing challenge and will now go forward to represent Ireland in a European showcase. So to fill us in on what exactly they've achieved, I'm joined by Richard Swan, who is one of the teachers behind the project. Good morning to you, Richard.
Morning, Patricia. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you're very welcome. And firstly, congratulations to everybody in the school. It's a fantastic achievement. But to get the background here, in order to take part, you and another teacher, Helen O'Connell, who I think is the principal, is she?
That's Helen, right.
You had to go away and upskill in 3D design and printing. Tell me about that.
That's correct. Well, we had established coding and robotics here in the school for a number of years, and we thought that 3D design and printing would be the next logical step. So luckily, a course came up in Cork, up in the Lifetime Lab, and myself and Helen O'Connell were able to attend. It was a fantastic course. It was funded by EIT Manufacturing and supported by iFarm and UCD and Stryker. So we learned about CAD design and 3D printing and the many applications it could have in the primary school classroom.
And the plus to it was you got a loan of a 3D printer, wasn't it?
Well, that was brilliant. We've got a long-term loan of a 3D printer. All the schools that participated got a loan of a 3D printer.
So then you came back with, yourself and Helen came back with all the skills you'd learned and the 3D printer under your arm, and you went back into the classroom. What then did you ask what were the school children then asked to do?
Well, first we started to learn about 3D printing and CAD design, and then we were asked to participate in a 3D printing challenge with a sustainability theme. So the children need to identify something in the school or their home that required fixing or improving. Of course, they came up with many fantastic ideas. But then we heard that we were getting new lockers for the school, and the children settled on the idea of key holders for the lockers.
So they then had to start from scratch and design them.
Yeah, they didn't want just an ordinary key box. They wanted something unique for the school.
Okay.
That was a bit of fun. All children like have a bit of fun. So two ideas quickly became the favourites. One featured the school crest, and the other was based around the popular computer game. And both ideas were so good, we'd print both ideas because we had two sets of lockers. So let's get busy then designing. And you have to solve design issues. It's very important. Something that looks good on paper is often not very practical. And in real life, maybe difficult to manufacture. Then they had to create prototypes using recycled materials. And again, there was more redesign involved in that. And then it was on to the CAD drawings. On the CAD drawings, we could do some quick prints just to see how things were looking.
Yeah.
And then finally, when we were happy with our final designs, we printed our two key holders.
And I've seen the video. They're excellent.
Well, all that videoing was going on during the design stage and during the print stage, because we had to put forward that video. But when we're looking at the clips afterwards, the group I have now, they're a particularly creative crowd, and they wanted to tell a story more than just present the project. So they wanted to bring in a bit of acting, and they even managed to work in a little bit of comedy. It's a fantastic job.
It's brilliant, and I would direct anyone to go to your website to see it. It's only about 2.5 minutes long. Well worth watching. It's excellent and really well put together. And obviously, Richard, the children have gained so much from this experience.
And this is only the start, because this is the start of our journey. There are thousands of tutorials online. It'll add to our science, history, geography. There's so much we'll be able to do.
So that video that I watched online, is that what you submitted for the judging?
That's what we submitted with a bit of paperwork.
Okay.
And that was judged then by iFarm and Stryker. And which was nice. We won a €1,000 voucher, but the children are really looking forward to going up to Stryker's facility in Cork. We're going to get a tour of their facility, and they'll get to see 3D design and 3D printing at work in a manufacturing setting.
Brilliant. It really is brilliant. And how did you find out that you'd won? Was it an email or was it a phone call?
We were invited to a webinar. All the participating schools were invited to a webinar, and we were fortunate. We came out the winner.
And did you think you were in with a chance, sir? What was your thought pattern when you sat down at the webinar?
It's very difficult to know. This is our first time doing this, and I thought our video was very good.
Yeah.
Now I thought the children made a great job of the video. It was all then down to the strength of our project, and yeah,
that's brilliant. You came out on top. And am I right in saying you now go forward to a European leg of the competition?
That's right. Next week there'll be a European showcase. Now again, I'm not quite sure. I know we're invited to a webinar again.
Okay.
And we'll be finding out more, I'm sure, next
okay.
week.
Okay, let us know. We'll keep our fingers crossed for you in that. And tell me, Richard, a little bit about the school, Toher. On paper, it looks like Toker, but it's actually pronounced Toher. And
yes.
It is, where in Dunmanway is it?
We're north of Dunmanway.
North of Dunmanway. What size school are you?
We're a small rural school, 3 teachers. We've been very involved, really, in digital and robotics and coding for the last number of years. We were fortunate there. We got involved with the School Excellence Digital Initiative that the Department of Education started. And this allowed us to get a wide range of coding and robotic equipment that we've established throughout the school, from 4-year-olds to 6th class.
From 4-year-olds?
Yeah, from junior infants up to 6th class.
Goodness
and
me.
So we've been working on that for the last 3 or 4 years. And I suppose 3D printing and CAD design, that was the next step. So.
And can you already see some of the older children, the 5th and the 6th class pupils who will be leaving you soon enough, can you already see them having careers?
I imagine so.
Yeah.
I mean, the technology is advancing so quickly these days. As they say, the jobs they have haven't been heard of yet.
Even invented, yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah. Okay.
These are the skills they're going to need.
Yeah, it is indeed. Well done. You're very proactive for a small rural school. It is terrific. So once again, congratulations to everyone at Toher National School in Dunmanway. And Richard, thank you for taking time out to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Patricia.
Good morning to you. Bye-bye. Richard Bye-bye. Swan there, one of the teachers behind that project. But it's a terrific achievement, as I say, for a small rural school.
You're listening to Cork Today on replay. Phone and text lines are currently closed.
I meant to say, because I heard it earlier on the 10 o'clock death notices, and then it went out of my mind. I meant to say, just pass on deepest sympathies to the O'Keefe family with the news of the death of Professor Michael O'Keefe. And of course, Michael O'Keefe, a native of North Cork, and his brother is Ned O'Keefe, a well-known former politician in the area. So many people will be aware of the O'Keefe family. And funny, we were talking about the O'Keefe chalice only today on the programme. But Michael O'Keefe was really a trailblazer when it came to ophthalmology services in Ireland. And I saw, for example, the National Council for the Blind saying how saddened they were to hear of the passing of Professor Michael O'Keefe. They say he was a leader in ophthalmology in Ireland, and he was a fantastic advocate for all people who were blind or were vision impaired, and he is going to be remembered certainly for many, many years to come. And he was one of those like truly pioneering ophthalmology surgeons, and extremely generous with his time. And actually, because of Professor Michael O'Keefe, there was a lot of premature babies who would be living life with blindness today only for the pioneering work that he did in a lot of the maternity hospitals, in Dublin. And I know also he was a brilliant advocate for common sense solutions in the health service. I mean, he was really, I'd heard him being interviewed a number of times, and he was always a breath of fresh air. And I don't know if I ever interviewed him. I have vague recollections that I may have interviewed him many, many years ago, but he was one of those ones who just, while he, you know, he worked as a consultant, but he just had a very common sense approach to our health service. And God knows, with everything that's going on in our health service at the moment, at times you think, why isn't there a bit of common sense in the midst of it all? So, as I say, our deepest, deepest sympathies to all the O'Keefe family on the passing of Professor Michael O'Keefe. May he rest in peace. And actually, just staying on health issues and a bit of a common sense approach, Dan has been on by text to say, hi Patricia, with the disastrous health situation, hospitals, overcrowding, not enough doctors, would it be possible to find out what percentage of the HSE budget actually goes on nurses, doctors, cleaners, porters, etc.? I bet that a big proportion goes to overpaid management who don't earn their colossal salaries and benefits. That's from Dan. Now, I don't know, and I'm open to correction, I don't ever think the HSE, while they'll say overall how much their wage bill is, they'll say for commercial reasons as well, that you won't get a detailed breakdown as to how much each individual gets. The latest set of figures I can find was an article that I read from the Journal from the summer of last year, and they were talking about the number of employees working in the HSE who earn in excess of €500,000, and it actually doubled last year. Now, the majority who are earning in excess of €500,000, in fairness, are hospital consultants. Like, they spoke about one hospital consultant being paid €750,000, €750,000. This was in 2021. Paul Reid, now, was mentioned. He was the chief executive at the time. He received €430,000. Now, that was a basic of €360,000. And then you take in things like he had allowances, he had benefit in kind for a company car. And then there was a large proportion of the allowances went to his pension contribution. But the figures, as I say, that came out in the middle of, the middle of 2022, but it would have been for 2021, that the figures showed that the number of HSE staff on earnings over 100,000 rose by 10%. So 3,988 people within the HSE earned over 100,000, but it doesn't give, unfortunately, it doesn't give a breakdown on how many of them are doctors, nurses, consultants, porters, kitchen staff, etc. And I don't know, I'll check and see. I don't know if I've ever seen those kind of figures in that kind of detail, Dan, that you're looking at. I know what you're talking about. You're very much and there will be a number of people who will agree with you, that there are too many, what we refer to as pen pushers, too many people working in admin, too many people working in management, enough, not enough boots on the ground. We constantly hear that argument when people talk about our health service. And then I was talking about modular homes earlier on. Michael says, how are you, Patricia? I think I read somewhere that a study shows that a very high percentage of the unfortunate Ukrainians who've had to flee their country because of war will never return to their home country, as the infrastructure will be destroyed. It will be impossible. This is therefore a long-term issue, says Michael. And I'm assuming Michael was responding to me saying that the modular homes that will be used for Ukrainians were told by the OPW when the Ukrainians go home, those modular homes then can be used for social housing. Now, I know this study that you are referring to, Michael, it was earlier this week. It was actually a briefing document that was given to Simon Harris when they were looking at the whole situation with the Ukrainian refugees and how long would they be staying here. And government officials, what they've worked out is they reckon that as many as 60% of Ukrainians who are in Ireland at the moment will remain after the war. Now, what are they basing those figures on? The estimates are based on the number of people who were displaced during the Bosnian War back in the 1990s. Now, back in the 1990s, there was 1.2 million recorded refugees from Bosnia at the time. Now, that was between 1992 and 1994. 40% repatriated back to their own home, while the remainder stayed in the first host country, or they moved on to a different country. So they're basing it on those figures. Now, while the legal basis under which temporary protection is being offered was the result of the Balkan experience, they say they can't assume that all Ukrainians will wish to immediately return home when the conflict ends. Now, at the moment, there's about 70,000 Ukrainians have already arrived in Ireland, and the expectation is that the same number will come again this year. So by the end of this year, there could be 150,000 Ukrainians living in Ireland. But they simply don't know. I mean, it really is a guessing game. As I say, they based it looking at other countries where the Bosnians fled to. Now, there was I don't know how many Bosnians came to Ireland. It wasn't a huge number. It certainly was nothing like the number of Ukrainians that are here. If you speak to Ukrainians, their wish and their will is to go straight home. But I absolutely accept the point that Michael is making, the infrastructure, you know, how do you go home to a home that isn't there? So, I mean, a lot of money, as always happens, after war situation, that's why the sooner it ends, the better. A lot of money will be poured into Ukraine to build back up the infrastructure. I think a lot will go back. A lot will go back because you've got to remember women and children who fled have left fathers, husbands, sons, brothers, you know, they've left their men folk, in the majority of cases, they've left their men folk behind them, and their lives are back in Ukraine. I mean, we would have seen that on all previous wars, even after the Second World War. People would have, you know, refugees would have fled. A proportion don't go back, for sure. Will it be as high as 60%? Only time will tell. Literally, only time will tell. 0818 103 103. And I want to give a quick shout out to Michael, who was on to us. Where's Michael's text from Bantry? Thanks for this, Michael. I mentioned about St. Bridget's Crosses earlier on when I was talking with Ken. And of course, next Wednesday is St. Bridget's Day. And if you would like to learn how to make your own St. Bridget's Cross, then there is an event happening in Bantry Library next Monday from 10 o'clock. You'll get one-on-one help to make your own St. Bridget's Cross. You simply can pop into or give Bantry Library a call on 027 50460 and ask for Geraldine. And the idea is that they'll do one-on-one every quarter for an hour. They reckon it takes about 15 minutes learning from scratch how to make a St. Bridget's Day Cross. So ask for Geraldine if you'd like to go along on Monday from 10 o'clock to Bantry Library. I know other libraries were doing that in the past. I remember having somebody who was going into Mallow Library many years ago, and she came into studio to help us make St. Bridget's Crosses. I made a dog's dinner of mine. I don't know what I was doing, but it turned out looking nothing like a St. Bridget's Day Cross. I wasn't very good at it. And I know she was going on to the library that day. So I don't know if other libraries are doing it as well. If any other library is arranging for St. Bridget's Crosses to be made, let us know, because people still have a keen interest in them. But Bantry Library definitely doing it next Monday from 10 o'clock. 027 50460.
The C103
Free Cork Diary.
With Cork County Council delivering roads and housing, community and business supports all across the county. See corkcoco.ie.
Ceilidh sets are going on in the Marion Hall in Ballinhasic tonight. That's at 9:30. Music is by Ger Murphy. Admission €10 and it does include teas. Bingo is going on in Mallow GAA Complex tonight, 8:15, with a jackpot of €4,700. And Kildarory Bingo is also on tonight, 8 o'clock in the store at the Creamery Yard. Doors open at 7 and their jackpot is €1,300. And an afternoon tea dance in Gagan Community Hall will be held next Sunday from 3pm to 6pm. Music is by Declan Anger. You can enjoy a welcome cuppa and goodies at the break. Plenty of car parking spaces as well. And the Lekela Mallow Men's Shed, they're holding their annual flag day tomorrow in Mallow Town. You're asked to please support this community group in the great work that they do throughout the year.
Cork Today on C103.
With Corrigan Insurance's Macroom, now part of McCarthy Insurance Group, for motor, home, business, farm, life and health insurance. See MIG.ie.
This is Cork Today on C103.
Email Patricia now with your story or comment. Corktoday at c103.ie.
And Patricia in Fermoy by text said she would willingly donate €20 if they set up a fundraiser to bring back the O'Keeffe chalice back to Ireland. Yeah, because I don't know. I mean, it was one of the points that I made to Michael, Deputy Michael Moynihan, when I was speaking with him. I mean, the V&A, the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, will say, look, we bought that at auction in good faith and they paid, I think it was £400. It's the equivalent of about €25,000 today. So they'll say, and that's what they are saying, that they bought it in good faith. So even if they decided that they were going to return it, would they look for financial compensation? And I'm sure if they did look for financial compensation and a fundraiser was to start, I'm sure people like Patricia would possibly donate. But there's no fundraiser at the moment, Patricia, but we'll keep you posted if that actually changes. Thank you for your text to 086 2103 103. Now, a rally was held on the Grand Parade yesterday afternoon, and it is to show refugees in this country that they are welcome in Cork. It was organised by a group called International Community Dynamics, who say the vast majority of Irish people are welcoming of those who come here seeking international protection. We sent our reporter, Mairéad Tuig, along to the rally to tell us how it all went.
Say it loud, say it clear.
Refugees are welcome here.
My name is Rose Lamol. I'm the CEO and founder of International Community Dynamics, and we're organising this this rally against the right wing and the anti-refugee sentiments that are being spread these days. Yeah. It's spreading all over Ireland. You've probably seen all the protests, people being misinformed and coming up blaming housing crisis and everything else on refugees, which is not fair. It's not fair on the refugees, and it's also causing a lot of fear, not only in the hotels where they were protesting, but everywhere, and also in the hotels here in Cork, not hotels, direct provision centres here. People are worried, and I think we need to show them that the majority of Irish people are behind them and support them.
How does it make refugees feel? Have they been confiding in you and telling you?
Well, they're shocked, you know, especially I have one who is on our board of management. We work, so half of our board are refugees, and our volunteers as well live in direct provision still. And they've shocked, because he said, I thought I came to Ireland because it's known for protecting human rights. And he said, I looked through my window. He sent me a video from Ballymun when they were protesting there. And he said, I'm so shocked, Rose. And the way they frighten mothers and children is just horrendous. So, and here as well, we have some people here from direct provision here in Kinsale Road. They're very worried. And their children are asking, when are they coming to us, you know, this year as well. So we have to make sure that they know that it is a minority, a loud minority, but we can be loud as well if we want to.
My name is Michelle. I think it's very important that people speak out. We're very lucky in Ireland. Their right has never taken a particularly strong hold. We are seeing a change in that, and I think it's very important not to have more angry shouting people, but just to showcase that the people who are outside direct provision are accommodation centres and who are scaring families. This is not all Irish people, and that there is support out there. I personally think that protest is supposed to be aimed at people in power or people who have the power to change what you want changed. Anyone who is in those centres did not choose to be there. The state has chosen for them to be there. For me, that is not protest. I think it's just blatant racism, to be honest. And some of the things that are being said through the gates, for me, would definitely come under hate speech. And I feel that it's not fair that it hasn't been enacted. And I think I'm very proud of the laws that we have around that stuff in this country.
The Cork that I grew up in and the Cork that I know are an understanding, are welcoming people, and communities across the city. The ones that always have their hands open. I have a personal story. My mom came from, and her family came from Belfast in the late 60s from the Troubles. And when they came to Cork, they were considered refugees, you know. And I suppose if I fast forward to today, my aunts and uncles are leaders in the community, you know. So this is what we can achieve by giving people, and whether you're refugees or whether you're Irish, we want to give everybody hope. We want to give that opportunity. And I think when we work together, we'll achieve that. And I can understand people's frustrations, but I think we need to be very clear of where we direct our frustration. I think, you know, hating is just the wrong thing to do. You know, we don't need that. The people that have come to our country have come for very good reasons. And the people living within our country that are frustrated need to be understood as well. But there are actions that we can do to address those issues with regards housing, with vacant properties, with dereliction, with boarded up council houses. Let's use that anger and that frustration and let's change that. Let's get those houses back open. Let's introduce taxes that tax the hoarding. But let's not hate one another, because I just think that achieves nothing. We're better, we're stronger together, and that's the angle we're coming from, and that's what we want to achieve.
Better and stronger together. Thank you for that. That was Murray Tuig covering that rally that was held yesterday on the Grand Parade in Cork to show refugees that they are welcome here in Cork. John in Cove, when I mentioned about that briefing document that was given to Simon Harris last week that shows it could, they've no way of knowing, but as many as 60% of Ukrainians who arrive in Ireland seeking refuge from the war could remain here after the war ends. And as John says, we don't know for sure, but he reckons many of them will decide to settle, particularly those that are allocated homes. They've all been given PPS, a number, so that it will settle into communities and they may decide to stay in Ireland for a better life. So we can't go ahead thinking that all of them will return when the war ends again. Says John, Ireland needs to plan ahead for this eventuality if 60% do decide to stay. And I think that has got a lot to do with why that briefing document was given to Simon Harris when he took over the responsibility for the Justice Portfolio in recent weeks. I think it's got a lot to do with planning, and rather than saying, oh, we didn't know, we didn't think that many was going to stay. So a briefing document has been given to them to say, look, this is what you need to plan for. So let's wait and see. And you're right about PPS numbers. I know the last figure that we had before Christmas, like 14,000 Ukrainians that have arrived in this country are already at work, some part-time, some full-time. I know a lot of the mothers with young children would love to be out working, but can't, because unfortunately this child minding issue with their children. But anyone that's free and available for work, a lot of them are already working. 0818 103 103. Now, I didn't see this. Is anybody watching Nationwide last night? Anne was, and she said, it made me so sad to sit down and watch Nationwide, the programme on TV last night. I can't understand what us, the lovely Irish, compassionate people have come to. I was looking at two people in wheelchairs. They're waiting months upon months for repairs, bearing in mind that these wheelchairs are their only mode of transport, especially the young lad who was saying that the chair was his legs. I actually felt ashamed to be Irish, said Anne, watching it. Now, I didn't see it, but I did see something on the paper this morning of a little lad in a wheelchair, so I'm assuming there was a follow-on for it. But yeah, when and that little lad is right. If you are permanently in a wheelchair, then your wheelchair is your legs, and it is your mode of getting around and making you independent and getting you from A to B. And if repairs need to be done, then can we please organise to have those repairs done immediately? And we were talking about catering on the trains yesterday. That's led to John Paul saying, like, we're hearing from Irish Rail that they're having problems getting a new contractor to take over the contract. It was Rail Gourmet had been doing it prior to the pandemic. Then obviously the catering stopped
after the when the pandemic started, and then when catering was allowed back on to the trains, Rail Gourmet said that they were having a problem trying to get staff, that they had staffing issues. They also said they had significant additional costs, and because of that, they terminated their Irish Rail terminated the contract with Rail Gourmet, and they failed to get anybody since. Even though I did see in the Echo during the week that they reckon they're close to some of the trains, not all of them, some of the trains having catering services, but a number of people are pointing out you can go from Cork to Dublin and then you get off that train and you can get onto a train, I think that goes out of Connolly, doesn't it, and go from Dublin to Belfast, and when you get on that train you get full catering. What is that all about? Well, Irish Rail point out that the catering services, that's the train is called the Enterprise Dublin to Belfast, is under a separate contract, and it is with a group called Corporate Catering Services Limited, and they're continuing to operate that on a limited basis. I wonder, could Corporate Catering Services Limited, whoever they are they an Irish company, or are they based Northern Ireland, or are they based here in the Republic? I wonder, could they be asked to take a look at the Irish Rail and see if they could do, if they're able to do it on the Enterprise from Dublin to Belfast, could they start doing it on the trains around the country? Wouldn't that be great? 0818 103 103. I mentioned St Bridget's Crosses. Thank you to, there isn't a name on this, but make, this is from somebody who sent me in a screen grab from Cork County Council's Library and Arts Service. Oh, it's via Declan Hardy. Thank you, Declan. Make a St Bridget's Cross in Dunmanway Library on next Tuesday. So Bantry Library is on Monday. Dunmanway Library is on Tuesday, 11:30 in the morning. You book your time slot by calling Dunmanway Library 023 88 55411, or you can email dunmanway.library@corkcoco.ie. Okay, so I take it, as I mentioned, had happened in the past that a number of libraries are organising for people to come in, experts to come in and show you how to actually make a St Bridget's Cross. So check in with your local library. 0818 103 103. John Paul's taking your calls. You can text or WhatsApp 0862 103 103.
Cork Today on C103
with Corrigan Insurance's Macroom, now part of McCarthy Insurance Group. They don't just talk the talk, they walk the walk. CMIG.ie.
This is the Cork Today replay on C103.
Mark Malone, our movie reviewer, joins me this afternoon. Good afternoon, Mark.
Hi, Patricia.
And you're very welcome. Now, I'm excited about this because it was only last night you went along to see this on Colleen Kuhn, and we were talking about it earlier in the week because, of course, it has been nominated for an Oscar, and you also saw a movie called I Love My Dad. Now, I have a trailer of on Colleen Kuhn. I have to say, embarrassingly, my Irish isn't great. Is this all Oscar Aelga?
Not all of it.
Not all of it, no. Okay, here we go.
How long should they keep her? Till after the baby?
She can't take it for as long as they like.
Well, ich an galin, sir.
Shasamach, good hour to miss Blech a carter.
Can work her. She led you out of house and home.
Oh, don't we all eat in spurts, same as we grow? We'll keep the child gladly. A yawn, ha, quite a dull, ha, boo.
Ni ffeddwl let o lefoni, Morson. O'n ar un tŵ me!
Na bych ag lord. Dwi'n rhaid fysig at.
Godfwy.
Bwch yl nigyn sy'n ag o'n chig. Gan led i'n bocht.
Isn't your mammy good to you?
Colleen Kuhn and Colleen Kena.
Der sy'n me disgodi ar ôl.
I have to say, I love Carrie Crowley when she's speaking in Irish. It's the Irish
I didn't
language.
Realise she was an actress, to be brutally honest with you.
Yeah, and a fine actress by all accounts. Yeah, okay. Now, I know it's a very small budget movie, hence the reason that there's so much excitement that it's made it to the Oscars. Anyone I know that's gone along to see it is loving it. And the basic storyline, I think a lot of people have seen the trailer, it's to do with them fostering or looking after, is it a relative's child?
The little girl, Coit, she's kind of living in a very kind of dysfunctional family. The father's an alcoholic, he's a farmer, there's not much money coming into the house. She's got three sisters. The mother has another child on the way. You know, there's constant references to the fact that they need to bring in the hay, but he can't afford to get this man to bring in the hay. It keeps kind of referencing the fact that the girls, and especially Coit, will eat you out of house and home, and so therefore that's why he doesn't have any money. So there's no relationship whatsoever between the girls and this kind of bullying kind of father. And so what they decide to do is kind of to take kind of some of the pressure off the family finances. They decide that Coit, played here beautifully by Catherine Clinch, they've decided that she should go and stay with some distant cousins of theirs, just to kind of, as I say, ease the finances of the family. And so she goes to live with Carrie Crowley and her husband Andrew Bennett. And they're much
Do they have children?
They don't have children. They're farmers as well, but they have a much more kind of they're much more successful farmers, so they have much more money. So all of a sudden, Coit is kind of suddenly kind of thrust into a very, very different world, where suddenly she's given a biscuit, which is kind of new to her. She's kind of doesn't really quite understand what to do, and she's quite confused by that. And initially, because of her kind of relationship and lack of relationship with her family, and because of the stress that she was going through, she initially kind of wets the bed. But she finds in Carrie Crowley a very, very different kind of warmth that she hadn't been kind of experienced before, for example. And it's called Colleen Kuhn, because she doesn't really talk very much, and everybody thinks she's a bit weird, but she isn't at all. She's just in this kind of dysfunctional family, and it's not really very good for her mental health. So all of a sudden, she's in a very, very different kind of environment.
A loving environment.
Initially, yes, but certainly from Carrie Crowley, with whom she has, a sudden kind of a relationship. Not so much with the husband, Andrew Bennett. That kind of takes a while because of something which has happened in the past. For example, Carrie says to her, you know, you don't have to have any secrets. There are no secrets here. But of course, there are secrets. There are secrets in every family, I think. And that's something that she finds out as time kind of progresses. And after a while, Andrew Bennett's kind of relationship with Coit begins to kind of thaw, and they begin a kind of relationship. And it's a kind of a completely new world for this little girl. And it's beautifully realised, I'm glad to be able to say. It really is. I met somebody who hated it, by the way. Yeah, okay. They thought it was just dreadful. They thought it was it's silly old nonsense. But it isn't. I mean, all this, the film, actually, if you listen to the conversation, the screenplay itself is just mainly conversation between people, you know what I mean? But that's not what it's about. It's about this little girl and her environments and how she's kind of dealing with being in this kind of very, very kind of, what is an alien world to her? A world of warmth and happiness and love. And so, and the way in which that's kind of portrayed is through her environment, where she is, the sky, the fields, the flowers, the trees, and all that is beautifully realised with a beautiful soundtrack, beautifully directed.
I loved the music, I have to say.
Yeah, and great, yeah. And the cinematography is absolutely gorgeous. And as you say, it's a small, tiny, it's a small budget film, but it's just beautifully done, and that's what you want. I mean, it won't be, as I say, to everybody's taste. Although, if you look at Rotten Tomatoes, I think it's at 93%. So
really
people
high.
Really, really do love the movie.
And I know it was one of these lockdown projects. It was filmed during the lockdown and the pandemic. I assume it was filmed here in Ireland, was it?
It's down in Waterford. It's set back in 1981. There's some lovely moments, by the way, when they got the TV on in the background, and they actually found the Quicksilver with Bunny Carr. They found Wanderley Wagon, commentary from Micheál O'Hare, which I thought was really, really lovely. It's a very gentle, very sweet, very moving, with beautiful imagery, and which I said, look, it won't be for everybody, but I thought it was an absolute delight. And this little girl, Catherine Clinch, I mean, she is a star of the future. She's another Saoirse Ronan. She has to be.
Is she?
She's absolutely terrific. She really is. The only, I've one thought, the only thing is obviously, a lot of the actors are natural Irish speakers, and so therefore, the conversation is a bit kind of, you know, when people kind of learn Munster Irish, and it's not really, it doesn't really quite flow. And that was the only thing at times when that I had problems with, because it just didn't seem kind of the conversation didn't seem natural, because you knew that they were speaking a language that they had learned, as opposed to something
Carrie Crowley is a native Irish speaker,
and she's the best thing in this movie. Yeah. I mean, she really is absolutely terrific. It's nominated for Best International Feature Film, and it could win.
Wow, and there's only five. They don't nominate a lot in that category.
Yeah,
there's only five. It's in with the shot. Yeah, I saw somebody say that the direction is restrained, and the acting beautiful throughout. And I thought that was a lovely description.
This little girl has these extraordinary blue eyes. And
yeah. And the fact that she, you know, in parts of it, she's not speaking. So it's got to be her facial and her reactions to things.
Well, exactly, yes. And because it's about her, as I said. She's like the centre of this new, different world. And so therefore she has to express herself, not so much through conversation, but through those extraordinary eyes. And she's amazing in it.
OK, someone said 100% agree with Mark on Colleen Kuhn. It was the best movie that I have seen in a long time. And someone else wants to know, where is it available? It's not available for download, sure it's not?
No, I went to the cinema last night. Unfortunately, there was me and two others in the cinema, which I thought was a bit of a shame.
Okay.
But it is in cinemas.
But it's still doing the rounds of the cinemas.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, your second movie is I Love My Dad.
Yes. Which is...
Okay.
This is one of the most uncomfortable films I have watched in a very, very long time. Goodness me. It's about catfishing. Do you know? You know what catfishing is, because you're a modern woman much more than I am. So I had to look it up. And basically, you know what catfishing is that somebody goes on the internet and pretends to be somebody that they're not. And so this is written and directed by a young man by the name of James Morosini. And he says it's based on a true story. And he says that this happened between him and his dad. So basically, there's him, there's his dad and his mom, and they too, like the other film, they're dysfunctional. They've all pretty much split up. His mother and father are divorced and have moved on. And he has decided that it's his dad who is responsible for the breakup of the marriage and the family. And so he decides to just break any communication with him in any way, shape or form, which, as you can imagine, you know, the dad is distraught because he loves this young man. He wants to be part of his life and finds that he can't be. And so he was sitting in a restaurant. He meets this young woman by the name of Becca. And suddenly he hatches this idea to go online to basically steal Becca's identity, takes photographs from her Facebook site, which is a bit creepy, and pretends to be this Becca online to reconnect again with his son.
Which
all sounds very, very dark and very, very weird. But it is based on a true story. The director says this actually happened. So throughout the film, you have some of the most uncomfortable things I've ever seen on screen, where, of course, the relationship begins to, you know, grow, and they become closer online, and they text each other an awful lot. And, of course, after a while, it becomes a little bit more emotional, and they start sexting. And so things like that make the watching of this very,
that's
very uncomfortable.
Ick.
And so what they do is, once they're texting each other, the actors portray themselves as if, you know, they are together.
Yeah.
And so whilst at the same time, the father is in the bathroom texting and pretending to be this girl. Now, it all sounds very, very odd and very strange, but for some reason it works. For some reason, it really, really is. It turns out to be sweet and gentle and very tender. And the thing is that you wouldn't think it would be, but that's all down to this young man, this director. This writer who's very, very good, and Patton Oswalt. Now, Patton Oswalt plays the father, which is a name that people might know. He's best known for the voice of Remy in Ratatouille.
Okay.
And he is absolutely terrific in the film. And you can see that it's all because, and the way, it's beautifully written, because it was just out of sheer desperation. And then, of course, it just propels itself out of control. And then he finds himself in a situation where he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know how to get out of it. And, of course, he feels terrible.
And, of course, the deeper he gets in, the harder it is to get out of it.
Exactly, yeah. So, and the thing is, you would think that, you know, initially it's creepy. Initially, I mean, I was watching this behind my hands. But it's gotten very good reviews, and people, I think, have seen the kind of sweetness and the tenderness and the gentleness behind it all, and the reasons why. And in the end, it's really rather lovely. And I have to recommend it. Not for kids, obviously.
Yeah.
It's an R-rated. I think it's 15s or 16s. But I would certainly recommend it. But there are times when it's not an easy
watch.
Yeah, once
you get over that uncomfortable part of it, it's worth the watch. Okay, I Love My Dad. Mark that out of 10.
I'll give it 7.
7 out of 10. And I forgot to ask you to mark on Colleen Kuhn. Somebody said you never marked mark it out of 10.
I'll give it 9.
9 out of 10. Yeah. All right. Listen, thank you for that. Have a lovely week.
Okay.
And we will chat to you again next week. That is Mark Malone, our movie reviewer. That OPW meeting, where they're meeting with councillors from the Mallow area and other public reps to outline what's
the plan for that site in Carrickeel and the works that's been going on at the moment, and is it a suitable site for modular homes for Ukrainians? I'm now being told is going to go on into this afternoon, so hence the reason that we didn't get any answer back today on it. But I promise you, we will be dealing with it probably first thing on Monday morning, because I know there was a lot of commentary this week from people just nervous about what's happening there. Let us know, fill us in please, so we'll have hopefully all of the information from that meeting on Monday morning. And to the person who was having problems trying to get their driving license with the NDLS website, we've contacted the RSA. They haven't come back to us yet, but no doubt we'll have an answer back from them on Monday as well. That's where I leave you for today. Thanks to John Paul McNamara, who produced Nick Richards with you for the afternoon. Talk to you Monday at 10. Have a lovely weekend.
On C103
with Corrigan Insurance's Macroom, now part of McCarthy Insurance Group. Want great advice? You know who to talk to. CMIG.ie.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.